From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With our minds, with our hands, and the tools we put in them, we humans have built an incredible world around us. Great buildings, canals, knowledge, so much more. But in the last few years, we've done something quite different. We've started to delegate our thinking, deciding, even our creativity to computers and their algorithms. More and more, we, our lawyers, doctors, farmers, engineers, factory workers, pilots, are guided, sometimes supplanted, by automation software. Writer Nicholas Carr says there's good that comes with that, but big problems too. This hour, On Point, Nicholas Carr on computer automation and our humanity. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is your life, your work, going automated? What does it mean when we defer, hand over the reins to our machines? How does it change life, change us? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Nicholas Carr, author, journalist, has made a big name for himself, questioning our relationship with computers and machines. His 2008 essay in The Atlantic, Is Google Making Us Stupid?, made big waves. So did his 2010 book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. That book was a Pulitzer Prize finalist and garnered him an hour on this show. His new book is The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. We have an excerpt at our website, put up by hand, I should say. Nicholas Carr, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Maria Bustillos, writing in the LA Times, calls you, says you've emerged as one of the information age's chief scaredy cats. Are you a big scaredy cat about our information age, Nicholas?
I don't think so. I don't feel very very much like a scaredy cat. In fact, I guess I should start with a confession that I'm actually quite fond of computers and have been for since I first started using a PC back in the 80s. And kind of my standpoint is that we're going to use these machines, and we're obviously using them more and more, so we should be careful about how we use them.
Lay out for us what you're talking about specifically. You've come out several times on Google, on the internet. Now you're talking about automation, and I wish you'd give us a bunch of examples of what you're talking about so people can really hone in on exactly your focus.
Yeah, by automation, I mean using machines and more and more computers to do stuff we used to do ourselves, or to do stuff on behalf of ourselves. And until recently, when you know the word automation was used, people would think about big machines in factories or robots in factories. But as we've moved from mechanical automation to digital automation, and as we all have computers going at work and carry them around on our person in the form of smartphones or whatever, automation has moved out of the factory and kind of more and more is infusing all aspects of our lives. And on the employment side, on the work side, you see all sorts of professionals handing over various chores, various parts of their jobs to computers, to computer algorithms.
Give us specific examples. Like what? What fields? Doing automation, doing what?
Well, on the level of there's a couple of different forms. One is what I'll call psychomotor skills, which is computers are much more adept at navigating the physical world. So you see pilots basically turning over much of flight, and this has gone on for a while, to computers. You see the latest automobiles taking over more and more of the basic functions of the driver.
You mean like auto braking if they see a problem ahead, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So what's called adaptive cruise control. So you're not just setting a speed and following it, but the car has radar that kind of can sense the car in front of you and so constantly adjusts your speed, puts on the brakes, and even keeps you centered in the lane by kind of reading the lane markings. And then beyond that, we're starting to see a lot of analysis and a lot of judgment making being turned over to computers. So doctors increasingly are, instead of taking notes on patients by hand or dictating them, are entering them into laptops or into their tablets. And it's not just automating the record keeping, but suddenly you have software beginning to guide the doctor through an exam, for instance, suggest an appropriate diagnosis, suggest a treatment. You see in law firms, what used to be a very kind of labor-intensive process of assessing evidence, what's called evidence discovery, mm-hmm. where you read through documents. It used to be done by junior lawyers and paralegals, lots of them, is now done by computers that can essentially read text, you know, tons of it instantaneously, and actually decipher kind of relationships between people, emotions. Architects, designers, more and more of their work is being mediated by computers.
How so?
And then in our personal lives.
An architect, it's hard for me to see exactly. How does that work? What's the computer do? What's automated?
You used to, not long ago, when an architect would start work on a project, they'd take out a pencil and a pad and they'd sketch by hand lots of different variations, kind of use their hand in the act of drawing to kind of begin to mentally compose their thoughts about this. And then the next stage would be they'd build a model by hand out of cardboard or foam core. Now all of that is done by a computer. And for instance, it's getting so sophisticated that, you know, an architect can put in the dimensions of a wall, say, and then the computer won't just draw a 3D picture of a wall. It'll add all the supports, all the insulation, put in the windows, put in the, you know, the brickwork, and kind of take over a lot of the kind of creative work that used to be in the hands of architects.
I was visiting a friend, a big farmer, not long ago, and we drove out to the field to see him. He was up in the cab of his big tractor texting and watching movies. The tractor was driving itself back and forth across the field, and it knew, you know, what fertilizer to put down where. That wasn't his job.
Yeah, in fact, someone told me that a lot of farmers, when they're, you know, when they're in the cabin of the combine or whatever, they're trading futures. And if you look at dairy farms, for instance, farmers don't actually have to go and touch their cows or look at their cows anymore. You have machines that feed cows, that milk cows, that take the manure out of the barn, that lead cows out into the field. And then you have sensors, body sensors that you can put on the cow. And so a farmer can sit in his, you know, bedroom and monitor the health of his cows from there.
What is the problem with this? We talked yesterday on the show to Peter Thiel, who's a big deal in Silicon Valley, an entrepreneur, an investor. He's worried about our lack of invention and scientific breakthroughs. And in his view, maybe the major thing that we're going to do that he thinks will save the world is move toward ever greater computer intelligence and backstopping and the singularity and all. I mean, to him, this is salvation, not a problem. You see it as a problem. Why?
I think there is a philosophy that is very deeply embedded in Silicon Valley and is kind of becoming embedded in our culture overall that somehow we're, as human beings, we're kind of deeply flawed. And the next great advancement, the next great manifestation of progress will be kind of to replace us with computers and get rid of that messiness that is inherent in human activity and human thinking. And I think that's a fundamentally misanthropic philosophy. I think it makes all these assumptions about the future that, in fact, we will have perfect artificial intelligence in computers, that they'll be able to become conscious and think like us and hence become us, but kind of a better version that doesn't make mistakes. That may happen. I can't predict the future, but there's no indication right now that that's going to happen anytime soon. Getting a computer from kind of being a mindless processor of information to a conscious being is a huge challenge. We don't know how we're conscious beings. So the thought that we can program computers to do that,
but the
maybe
steps
we can.
Toward that involve all the kind of automation that you're decrying. Peter
right.
Thiel, it seems to me, is embracing it, saying it will free us up for bigger, better things. Again, what's the problem with the automation?
Well, you know, the point is, so we can't assume that our computers are going to be able to take over from us. We're going to work in conjunction with our computers. And there's all sorts of important talents that human beings have that we need to bring to bear in the things we do. And the problem with automation is that the way it's designed currently, more and more it takes the human being out of the most interesting, most difficult work, the challenges. And as a result, we're not developing rich skills, the skills that only come when you're actually engaged with the world, when you're working on hard challenges, when you're immersed in your work. And so there's this, again, another fantasy that, oh, anytime we should give as much as possible of our work and our chores over to computers, and that frees us up, you know, as mm-hmm. you're saying, Peter Thiel said, to do greater things. Well, that's a nice thought, but and it used to be true when automation was basically mechanical, and so it was taking over kind of routine manual labor and allowed us to have time to think. Now it's as it moves up the kind of ladder of human skills, if you look at a lot of occupations, you don't see automation freeing people up to greater levels of achievement. You see it turning them into computer operators. So if you look at pilots, for instance, well, once the automation is flying the plane, the pilot more and more spends time watching monitors, entering data, taking over in emergencies. It's not as though the pilot is up there, you know, writing books of philosophy in the cockpit. It's actually diminished their engagement and diminished their skills. And I think as this moves more and more across the, you know, professional landscape, it's doing that to more and more people and more jobs.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about computer automation moving in all over the place, factories, airline cockpits, law offices, GPS, your brakes, and what it means for us, the humans, when we defer, hand over the reins to our machines. Nicholas Carr is my guest. He's author of the new book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. You can read it from an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's a little sound. This is 5 years ago now, so things have gone much further now. But this was Northwest Airlines Flight 188. It overshot the airport it was supposed to land at, Minneapolis, by 150 miles. The two trained and, as tests confirmed, completely sober pilots later admitted they'd been distracted, doing research on their laptops, letting the onboard computers fly the plane. Almost bizarrely, ground control had to make sure the human pilots were really in control of the aircraft before allowing the plane to land. Here's a report from MSNBC.
Before landing, the pilots were put through a series of maneuvers in the air to prove to controllers they had command of the aircraft.
Number 188,
6,000,
under the speed of 190
short. Under 6,000, in slow to 190 northwest, 188.
Who's in charge up there? Nobody knew. Vint Cerf, called one of the fathers of the Internet, now Google's chief Internet evangelist, was on the Colbert Report in the summer, talking about how the Internet was originally conceived back in the early 70s as a way to automate how the U.S. military fights its wars.
The original project was done to help the Defense Department use computers in command and control. If you think about it, a computer can help you figure out how to manage your resources better, which might mean that a smaller force could overcome a larger one if the smaller one could manage its resources better than the opponent.
And are you the one who built the switch where you turn it on, the computer takes over and kills all of humanity? Because that's the way that movie goes. I've seen that movie.
That wasn't the plan.
Okay.
And a little more from Vint Cerf here. Colbert asked about the downsides of computers doing our work for us.
What do you make as one of the fathers of the Internet of our fear that computers will take over and make us obsolete? Do you think there's anything to that idea?
I think that not in that form. What I do think, though, is that we should be worried about computers that make mistakes, because they can make mistakes faster than we can.
Yes, they can. Nicholas Carr's new book is The Glass Cage. He says we're in it. Lots of callers for you, Nicholas. John, in Providence, Rhode Island. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom and Mr. Carr. Intrigued by your topic and something that I've felt for a long time. I happen to be a physician,
Okay. And
I specialize in bipolar disorder in children, adolescents, and adults.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have found, two points I'd like to make. One is that things have become so mechanized and box-checking so they can enter the data, even at Harvard institutions, so that when I get a patient, and I usually am the fifth psychiatrist down the line, to see someone who's not gotten well anymore, I end up wondering, is this the same patient I just saw and spent an hour with talking to the parents and whatnot? Because I have a completely different history from what the checked boxes would say.
Why do you think the checked boxes come up with a different profile, John?
Because they don't really look at the family. They don't really talk to the family. They don't get a feel for what's going on or what the patient has been through. They don't ask relevant questions about childhood, about Aunt Tilly and Uncle Morris.
Maybe it's just early days, Dr. John. Maybe further down the road they'll get better and everything will be fine.
I doubt it, because it's only been getting worse and worse and worse. And I've been doing this for around 40 years. And let me just tell you one other thing that's very important, because it's more expensive doing it this way. In Texas, where they said tort reform was necessary to lessen the cost of medical care, mm-hmm. they passed tort reform laws. So they have a very reasonable tort reform background yeah. for medical liability.
Okay.
However, the cost of care has gone up because people are doing diagnosis by lab tests and x-rays. They are not sitting and thinking. They don't say, well, gee whiz, what's going on? And I remember some years ago when two pediatric neurologists, one in a teaching hospital, three pediatricians, one in a teaching hospital, couldn't figure out what was wrong with this kid and why was he acting the way he was. I sat down and I met with the family and whatnot for several hours, which the insurance company didn't want to reimburse me for. But after a while, I made the diagnosis of something called Wilson's disease.
John, I think we've got it. You were more subtle than the machine. You raise very good points, a lot of them, and I want to grab right there. Let's hold this one, Nick, if we can. I mean, as you point out, computers don't just do the work. They shape the work, and with that, they can shape the outcomes. There's a report from the medical front. We've got Brian in Montreal, in Canada. Brian, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Nicholas. I want to echo what this physician just said, but my perspective as a professional structural engineer over the past 40 years is awful similar. I'm also a child of the counterculture, so I already had a prejudice against letting the big man take over, and my experience is that the computer has taken the job of the man, which we resented so much when we were so much younger.
But even in engineering, Brian? How? What?
Yeah. Well, let me give you an example. I'm the last generation of engineers who started to learn our profession using a slide rule. And a slide rule, if nobody's ever used it, because few people have, it lets you do multiplication and division and taking powers and exponentials, but only to one or two numbers of the whole answer.
Yeah.
You can only get the most important answer in terms of the first number or the first two numbers.
Okay.
You also doesn't put the decimal place on the answer, so you have to constantly be alert. Is this 300 or 3,000 or 3 million? And even if you're not conscious of that as a designer or a person looking at a design, you have to always get in your head, is this answer reasonable? Is it possible that I'll need 3 million truckloads of cement? And of course you can't.
But surely the computer is programmed in such a way that it's not going to present ridiculous structures.
But it does, in fact. And I can give you some specific examples.
Really?
And I've seen some images of construction going on in Europe and some commentators from the European Union who are very concerned that we shouldn't be wasting resources. They have done some studies on computer-designed buildings, and they make it absolutely clear that they use 15 to 20% more steel than would be required if anybody actually used their brains to decide.
And you're sure, Brian, that this is not just you in love with an old tool that you grew up with. You know, humans have loved tools, slide rule included, I suppose.
I only gave that example because
yeah.
it tells you where I come from.
Yeah.
But when I talked, and I taught 30 years ago, young students who want to become designers and the technician in the construction site office who wants to order the right number of truckloads of cement.
Yeah.
They literally, because they had never had to think about the answer, could not divide a number by 10. They had to take their calculator out and punch in 60423 divided
that,
by
that
1.
That sounds nuts. Divide by 10, that's about as basic as it gets in your arena.
They did not have that elementary understanding of arithmetic.
Because
and
it's been handed off.
That, you can't keep in your mind the big picture.
The tangible kind of intellectual engagement with the subject. Nick Carr, I know this is piling up in your corner. One more and I'll bring it to you. Brian, thank you. In Montreal, New Orleans, Laurel is calling. Laurel, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
First, I'm not a zombie. I know how to do math.
All right.
The other thing is I operate in both realms as an architect, educated through that, mm-hmm. and I'm an artist.
Okay.
So my daily pursuit is as an artist, I'm a sculptor. And I work in glass, which is a pretty challenging material,
Sounds
and
great.
Also in steel.
Sounds great.
you know, like I couldn't do some of the things I do without computer-aided design technology.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to throw this out there and then I'll get off the phone.
Okay.
You know, like some buildings now are incredibly complex items. I think, you know, I have a lot of friends in this, in the architecture field. They work on buildings that the systems within the buildings are spaghetti. And without the building information modeling that they have available to them, I don't know that the buildings could actually service the people that they need to service. So I'm talking, you know, like healthcare.
Yeah, so you're for it because it enables us to do things we couldn't do otherwise, you're suggesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can go from a sketch to a computer to an actual three-dimensional object pretty quickly, but we don't use it as a crutch.
Are you sure? Are you positive? No, are you sure? It's not slowly eating away at your deep skills and talents, Laurel?
No.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, it has increased my viability as an artist.
Laurel unbound by the computer support she gets there, the automation. All right, Laurel, thank you very much in New Orleans. Nick Carr, there's a groaning table right away of testimony, and it's on both sides, interestingly. We should respond. Medicine, engineering, and engineering plus art.
Well, I think Laurel makes a very good point, which is that there are extremely valuable things that computers can do to aid us. And it's true that if you're building a building and you need to have energy efficiency, that's very difficult for us to figure out, but you can program a computer to do it. And as Laurel mentioned that she starts with the sketch and then goes to the computer, and that seems to be a good way to do things. Unfortunately, the computer is beginning to take over the sketching operation, and that's where problems come in. You start to see impersonal architecture. One architect told me that it used to be when he looked at a building, he could see the hand of the architect, and now he sees the computer program in the building. But what both John, the doctor, and, mm-hmm. and Brian, the engineer, got at is are good examples of something that the scholars of automation call the substitution myth. We think that we can bring in a computer or a machine to do things we used to do. And it won't change the work. It'll just make it more efficient or more precise or whatever. And what we see, in fact, is that it fundamentally changes the work. So you bring in digital medical records and, you know, as John was saying, the checkbox approach to medicine. And a number of things happen. One thing is that the cost reductions that you assumed would come don't actually manifest themselves.
I don't get that.
As
I have
John
to say.
Said,
I mean, it seemed like if you've got uniform digital medical records as a sometime patient, that sounds great to me. How many times have we filled out those forms and you wonder, why am I filling this out for the 100th time? Surely I could put it in once, all this information, it'd be out there and be automatically produced when doctors need it. That seems good to me.
That is a good thing. Unfortunately, a lot of the systems that have been installed are proprietary systems that actually don't share information very well among different practices. But you're absolutely right that there are good things about electronic medical records. But what happens is that, for instance, when you go into an exam with a doctor, studies show that the doctor spends about 25% to 50% of the time looking at a computer rather than engaging with you. That's a problem that doctors feel, that patients
yeah.
feel.
Eyes on screen, not eyes on patient.
Right. And as John said, there's suddenly when you get electronic medical records, instead of writing or dictating the story about the patient, doctors do use checkboxes. They use what's called cloned documentation, which means they cut and paste from earlier visits, from other patients' visits. And what happens is then when that information is shared with another doctor, as one doctor has explained it, the story's just not there. You don't have this rich sense of the patient. And also all of these things are tied into billing systems, invoicing systems, and they're programmed to kind of increase patient bills. So certainly we can see ways that we can design these systems, whether it's in medicine or engineering or whatever, or architecture, to get the benefits without intruding on human skill and human touch. But unfortunately, we're going in a different direction.
We heard from Vint Cerf there talking with Stephen Colbert. And I wonder if you can really put a harness on this or rein this in. I mean, Vint Cerf talked about how this internet was originally for the military, command and control. You quote Thomas Adams in your book, The Glass Cage, at the U.S. Army War College, saying that, look, there's not much choice anymore. He says that the logic leading to fully autonomous systems is inescapable. He says, thanks to the speed, size, and sensitivity of robotic weaponry, warfare is, quote, leaving the realm of human senses, and quoting again, crossing outside the limits of human reaction times. That suggests, whether it's warfare or very complex structures, that Laurel in New Orleans is saying humans can't get their heads around all the infrastructure, the spaghetti of infrastructure required, that our expectations are outrunning our direct skills. We need computers at this point, Nicholas.
It's often true that once you computerize an area of human effort, it gets very hard to back away. And you can see this very clearly in the financial arena where computers can trade stocks, you know, millions of stocks a second. In about the time, you know, you can barely form a thought, the computer is trading the stocks. And there are big questions about whether that's – how valuable that really is, and also what kind of dangers, what kind of risks are raised. And Vint Cerf's, you know, got to this, that it's kind of out of our control now. By the time you can pick up the fact that there's a problem and fix it, you know, a huge amount of damage might be done. And we are – on the verge, at least, of seeing a similar thing happen in warfare, in the military, because, you know, as soon as the robot or the drone begins making its own decisions about when to shoot and when not, and we haven't crossed that barrier yet, but technologically we're probably there, then you get this pressure for all armies to follow suit because you don't want to be put at a disadvantage. So I think, you know, wherever you look, there is a point at which it becomes hard to back away because you've basically re-engineered the whole process to operate at computer speed. But to me, that puts even greater emphasis on the need to think clearly about these things that are happening and wisely about them, and to not just say, well, this is inevitable, but to say, you know, these are human processes. These are programs that human beings create. Let's do it well.
Are you really talking about putting the brakes on here? Is there a tool of such power that we've ever, humans, invented that we didn't use and use a lot?
Well, there are some examples of, in a lot of this comes from the military, of tools that we've decided not to use, that we've chosen not to use and have been able to do that.
We use nukes and we keep them at the ready even now. We're using them in a sense even now as deterrents.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could take a fatalistic view and say, well, let's just back away and let ourselves be run over by these systems. But I think there are better ways to design these things. And people who look into this have laid these out, and we're just choosing to ignore that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about computer and automation moving in all over the place, factories, airline cockpits, law offices, GPS, your brakes, and what it means for us, the humans, when we defer, hand over the reins to our machines. My guest is Nicholas Carr, author of The Shallows, The Big Switch, Doesn't Matter, of the essay Is Google Making Us Stupid? His new book is The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. He's kind of asking now, is automation making us useless? Joins us from New York. We've got philosophy to go to here and maybe some thoughts on how to engage optimally. So many callers, though. Jerry, San Diego, California. Jerry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I was recently on a long hike. I'm an avid hiker of a certain age.
Okay.
And the younger members of our party were utilizing a GPS device to find the trail. And at some point, the GPS device started to not work properly, as well as run out of power. And I found that none of the younger hikers knew how to use a map and compass. And we actually had a couple of friendly disagreements about where the heck we were in the wilderness. And by actually pulling out the map, pulling up the compass and pointing to a couple of peaks that we could triangulate with, they finally were convinced that we were, you know, about to go the wrong way if we hadn't taken the right turn.
So, Jerry, what's your best guess? Do we face a future in which, if the power goes out, we're lost in the woods, or will we keep, you know, the sort of automation and the skills alive side by side?
Well, I think that we have to sort of not only embrace it to the point where it's helpful, but not to rely on it completely. For instance, hikers that are lost can utilize a transponding device to be found later on, and that's great tech. But you also have to have a support system. For instance, the GPS devices that they were used were supported by a portable solar panel that was attached to the back of their packs, and as a result, you know, they're adding quite a bit of weight, but without that solar panel and without that GPS device, Lord knows where they'd end up.
Jerry in San Diego, I really appreciate your call. We've got a lot to get to, but thank you for calling on that front. Nicholas Carr, I want to come to you here on human nature and how it leads us to interact with automation. But one more first, if I may. Jack in Franklin, Tennessee. Jack, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm going to take a little different tack than your guest. I'm an airline pilot, and you claim that automation doesn't free us up to do other things and sites that we're not writing books on philosophy as an example, but that's not what we're supposed to be doing. And example, the Northwest pilots was a good example of what we're not supposed to be doing, and that's looking at our laptops.
Right.
But what it really does is it frees us up from the more menial tasks of flying an airplane, which is keeping it going in a certain direction at a certain altitude, a certain speed.
Yep.
Take a bigger picture, look at the perhaps rapidly changing weather or other situations, and apply our knowledge and experience to that.
So you're not up there playing Angry Birds or reading Aristotle or you know, you've got the big picture and you're more free to do that, you're saying, Jack.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, we're supposed to use our knowledge and experience and be more, I guess the term of art now is systems managers. But the thing is, we're free to select our level of automation in the cockpit. That it ranges anywhere from no automation to fully automated. And, you know, it's more a matter of our individual company's direction and preferences as to what degree of automation to use. And I think lately the focus has been on more variants of your level of automation just so that you can maintain those skills that you had when you got hired.
That's interesting. Sort of push the lever back and forth, so sometimes you have to be more in charge, more engaged. Jack, I appreciate your call. Nicholas Carr, if I may, there we've got hiking and map and compass and GPS. There we've got a pilot who says, let me have it. I'll do the higher level stuff. I can see how we could look directly at what they've put forward there, but I wish you'd take it to human nature and how we tend over time to interact or some of the almost essential nature of our interaction here. It gets to human desire, what we want, what we think we want, and how we pick up this computer automation and use it. What do you see, Nicholas?
Well, there was an interesting study done back in the 80s, I think. And what arose from that is a concept called the paradox of work. And essentially what the researchers found is that people desire to be freed from hard work, freed from labor, freed from effort. And yet when you look at what makes them feel happiest and most satisfied and most fulfilled, it's when they're working hard, struggling with a hard problem, facing a challenge, exercising their skills, expanding their skills. So we have this kind of internal conflict or tension that's sometimes called miswanting. We want things that actually don't make us happy and vice versa. And I think that explains why we're so quick to – why we fall in love with computers and automation so quickly and kind of want – quickly hand over everything to them without even thinking about it, because we think that this will either give us a life of leisure or free us up to have higher thoughts or whatever. But actually, it tends to have the opposite effect. We become less satisfied and less fulfilled when we're simply not doing anything, when we're not challenged. And to me, that kind of gets at the nub beyond the economics, beyond the issues of productivity. Unfortunately, our bias is to simply hand things over to computers and only afterwards realize that, gee, what really makes me happy, makes me fulfilled is actually figuring things out, working hard, engaging with the world, you know, being able to use a compass and a map to figure out where I am or whatever. And so there is a kind of existential aspect to this. I mean, as we've moved from the automation of production in factories to the automation of human experience, which is what we're seeing today, this desire to just simply be freed from effort becomes really problematical.
And freeing our bodies from doing the work, you quote the French philosopher Maurice Merleau-Ponty back in his big work, Phenomenology of Perception. He says, the body is our general means of having a world. This is very different from the singularity guys. Ray Kurzweil, who's now top guy engineering at Google, who we've had on this show, who talks about not even having a body one day, sort of merging with computer and leaving the corporeal behind. That's fine by him.
Well, we are creatures of the earth. We're not – I think what those guys want to think of us as is these little dots on GPS maps. But that's not what we are. We're people in bodies, animals in bodies, and we get satisfaction from interacting with the world. What Merleau-Ponty was saying is that by expanding our skills, we also expand the meaning of our life, our ability to interact deeply with the world and to find satisfaction there. And he points this out, and I want to emphasize it. Tools, technologies can play a big role in that. You know, we can design tools that actually bring us out into the world and allow us to expand our potential and expand our talent, or we can adopt software that turns us into observers of screens. And this is a big choice that is out ahead of us now, and that actually, without even thinking about it, we're determining the course we're taking with the choices we make right now.
I can't resist going just a bit here to the poetic. You've got a wonderful passage where you look at Robert Frost when he was up in Derry, New Hampshire, writing, finding his voice, as you say, that distinctive voice, plain-spoken, conversational, but also sly and dissembling in a way. But in A Boy's Will, that collection, he has a poem called Mowing. Takes me back, but it's got, you know, he opens it with, this is a man out in his field. He's cutting the alfalfa to make hay or to make hay there. And it's the old style scythe, the long blade that you have to swing rhythmically again and again. And the poem goes, there was never a sound beside the wood but one, and that was my long scythe whispering to the ground, sort of immersed in that repetitive labor motion. And he comes to this line, Robert Frost in Mowing, the fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows. The fact of what, Nicholas?
Well, I wish I could completely unpick that line, but fortunately it remains somewhat mysterious in a beautiful way. But I think what Frost is getting at is that acting in the world is the source of beauty, the source of satisfaction, the source of transcendence. Even ironically, it's about, you know, being part of the world that allows us to transcend our everyday worries and fears and so forth. And it's a beautiful explanation of how being deeply engaged in work using a tool, the scythe, you can't. Mm-hmm. You can't cut hay or with your fingers. It's very hard. Enlarges us, I think the big challenge for us is how do we take that engagement? How do we take the use? You know, the model of the farmer with a scythe being completely deeply engaged in his work. How do we transfer that to our use of computers and software? And I think it's possible. But I think it really requires us to challenge the dominant design ethic, to challenge some of those folks in Silicon Valley who don't much like human beings in their bodies, and to take a different approach.
You're right. I must say rather beautifully yourself, and let me read from it, about Robert Frost's poem, Mowing, describing what's going on there. You write, he's a farmer, a man doing a hard job on a still hot summer day. He's not dreaming of idle hours or easy gold, quoting Frost's poem there. His mind is on his work, the bodily rhythm of the cutting, the weight of the tool in his hands, the stalks piling up around him. He's not seeking some greater truth beyond the work. The work is the truth. Nicholas Carr's interpretation there of Robert Frost in Mowing. We're talking about automation and human skills, maybe the human soul. Brian, in New Orleans, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Well, I'm a photographer, and one of the problems that we're facing in photography is digital photography and the constant updating of cameras and how cheap they've become to the public. So everybody's a photographer now. It's causing our price point to be driven down by Craigslist photographers. And then also the market of photographers is being saturated by people who don't know how to use their cameras. So people are just kind of putting their hands in technology and allowing themselves to go out there and do the job that people have trained for a very long time to learn how to do very well.
So in this case, even if you yourself don't embrace the automation that a digital camera represents, you're still being, what, driven out of work or challenged by the mass adoption?
Well, I do definitely use digital cameras. I'm a wedding photographer. I wouldn't be able to do it without digital cameras. I think it's just unfortunate that technology has kind of made people ignorant to how photography actually works, light, exposure of light, because no one is learning these techniques anymore. They don't question. The camera makes all the decisions for them.
Boy. And if it weren't there, Brian, I appreciate your call from New Orleans. West Palm Beach, Florida. Maria, you're on.
Yes. Okay, my comment is that unfortunately, either this whole technological progress has been very short-sighted because we have a extremely antiquated electrical grid and we have satellites that have a shelf life that are orbiting the Earth. And if there were some catastrophes, we've seen them, or shorting out or falling down, our lifestyle, we wouldn't know how to communicate. We wouldn't know how to do much of anything because we've become so reliant on this technology. So
we'd be ninnies, kind of back in the Stone Age, have to figure it all out again. Maria, you've got a point. Let me get one more. I appreciate your call, Maria. Derek in San Marcos, Texas. Derek, you're our last caller. Thanks for being there.
Oh, thank you, Tom. The gentleman was talking about work, the work of a human being. Maybe what we need to be doing is, changing our priorities from the practical kinds of things that everybody's been talking about all hour long to the things human beings can do, but we never have.
Like what?
Stopping killing each other. Feeding the hungry, like caring for the suffering, all the things that have defied our abilities for thousands of years.
So let the computer build the bridge and we'll go out and be saintly. Hard to know. Thanks for calling. Nicholas Carr, what if the power goes out? What if we were freed from these tasks to do higher level things? Where do you see it going?
I think at its best, automation, like mechanization before it, can push us to higher things. And one way to do that is to automate tasks that we've already mastered. Use a calculator to automate arithmetic and mathematics that you've already learned, and then you can build on that. Too often, though, we're using automation simply to displace our need to learn. And so you use the calculator to do the math and the arithmetic, and then the automation prevents you from rising higher. So if we use these powerful technologies wisely, if we respect human skill and say, first we have to learn deeply certain sophisticated tasks, and then when they become automatic for us ourselves, we can begin to automate them with machines, and that kind of provides us a step up the ladder of skills. I think that's the smart way to do it. The smart way to do it isn't to say anything that a computer can do, a computer should be doing it and humans shouldn't be doing it, because that's just kind of a naive approach to what actually – how we develop skills, how we achieve satisfaction in our lives. It's not by being freed up from things. It's by mastering things and then moving up slowly the ladder of skill to even higher things.
Who's going to promote that approach? Is Silicon Valley going to approach the learn it first, or they're just as happy if we rely on the automation?
I think it's the public and the way we use the technology and the choices we make about which technology we buy and which technology we don't.
Nick Carr, you always make us think, and we're grateful for that. what was that again? The chief scaredy cat of the information age? Maybe, but maybe not. Maybe a smart observer here. We appreciate your being with us today. The new book is The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. Nicholas Carr in New York, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.